How I Met Your Mother. How I Met Your Mother.
How I Met Your Mother.
How I Met Your Mama.
Ted just had a huge date. How'd it go, dude?
I want to be married by the time I'm 30. And yet, I keep falling in love with the wrong people, being really bad at dating. We wrote all that in a story.
You could have ended the show quite a few different ways.
There's an alternate ending to the show. I felt very connected to Ted and Tracy, and I sort of loved the idea of them living happily ever after.
So obviously the show just picked up so much success, and instantly you're kind of thrust into the spotlight as the guy who created How I Met Your Mother.
And yet you wrote The Mutual Friend.
Dating has changed. The whole game has changed. And now everything is on the phones. And that got me thinking a lot about technology. Got me thinking a lot about like our relationship to technology. And that was sort of the inception of The Mutual Friend.
This is The Loaf Podcast. Welcome back to the bakery, everyone, where we break bread with the world's finest. Today, we're here with Carter Bays. He's the co-creator of How I Met Your Mother, where he served as showrunner and writer for all 9 seasons. In 2022, he published his debut novel, The Mutual Friend. Carter, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here. I didn't realize there was bread involved. Is there bread? Is there? I guess it's we're doing this over the internet, so maybe not.
If you were in person with us, we'd probably have a bit of bread with you, but with us rather, and eat it.
Okay, yeah. I could fill this whole hour talking about bread and how good it is, but I know you guys you're very busy, so.
Yeah, I mean, we usually ask our guests what their favorite bread is.
Okay.
So yeah, we're happy to hear your answer to that. First of all,
can we just dive into that right now?
What's your favorite bread?
Well, I'm at the restaurant and the basket arrives. If there's pretzel bread, I go for that immediately. That's a no-brainer. As a New Yorker, I love a good bagel. I could shout out Bagels & Company, Absolute Bagels, H&H are 3 of my favorites. A good rye. If I'm having like a pastrami sandwich, rye bread is the way to go, I think.
Yeah. We felt... I mean, you're a showrunner. You understand how it is when a joke might start to run a little bit dry. And excuse my pun there. But basically, we've been asking all our guests. All our guests basically for 30 episodes what their favorite bread is, and we find that the answers we usually get are sometimes a little bit similar, and also not that they don't tell you that much about a person. But we like to think that they do, but it turns out not so much.
That was quite a passionate response from you, though. That was quite... You gave a lot of detail. We usually get a one-word answer for that kind of thing, so...
All right, well, I have opinions. And I also, you know, I don't favor any one bread. It varies from day to day. Like, if there's something nutty with, like, little raisins in it, that sometimes that beats out pretzel bread. You never know. It's a day-to-day thing.
Ever shown up to the beach with a big bush, getting rejected left, right, and center, so you have to walk away with your pubes between your legs? Then get yourself a Manscaped and rule the beach. Wear your shorts with no shame. Get the Performance Package 5.0 Ultra now with a discount code LOAF to get a full 20% off so that your baguette leaves no crumbs.
I mean, bread's been around for a long time, almost as long as kind of How I Met Your Mother, at least in the cultural kind of conscience.
In the history of civilization, I mean, bread and How I Met Your Mother...
Probably I'd say even a little bit longer than that.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. It's probably a difference of 5 to 10 years if we're looking at it like a grand historical lens.
How did you kind of like take the dough of How I Met Your Mother and kind of bake it into the final product then back in 2005?
That's a good segue. I'll give you that. Well, okay. So in 2005, I'm going back 19 years now. Craig Thomas and I were writers for, we had written for a show called David Letterman for 5 years, which was an American talk show. And then that was here in New York, and we had spent 5 years living in New York. It was right out of college, and it was just like the most fun 5 years of our lives. And we were just like, running around, like learning to take taxis and having apartments for the first time and just having this. And I was a single guy, and I was like totally bad at it, but I was like running around being single. Craig was in a very steady, relationship with his girlfriend at the time, who would soon become his fiance and then his wife and is still his wife. And, um, those 5 years were just like a lot of fun. We made so many lifelong friends working on that show. And every Thursday night that show was five shows a week. On Thursday, we would shoot the Thursday and Friday show so that the host, Dave Letterman, could have a 3-day weekend. And so we would get out of work usually like around 9 o'clock, 9:30 on Thursday night. And everyone would go to this one bar that was like right around the corner called McGee's. And it's still there. It's on 55th Street and Broadway. 55th? I think it's 55th. Just a really, really happy time. But Craig and I, we knew that we wanted to write other stuff. We wanted to write, that was just writing jokes we would do like the top 10 list, and it would just be a list of 10 jokes. We knew that we wanted to do something more. We wanted to write stories. We wanted to write about characters. We had more in us than just jokes. And so we decided to leave, and we wanted to write half hour comedies and write sitcoms. And the place to do that is Los Angeles. So we had to leave New York because there really weren't any sitcom jobs in New York. All the sitcom jobs were in LA. So that's what we did. We moved, which was heartbreaking. And you know, because we love New York, and New York is home. And it's where we knew we'd always end up eventually. But for the time being, it was like kind of like I likened it to like going out. Like if you work on an oil rig in the Gulf of Mexico, like you just go and live on the oil rig for 6 months, and it's hard to get there, it's hard to get back. But so you just like say like this is my time to do my work, and then when I get home, that'll be home. And that's kind of how I always felt about Los Angeles versus New York. So we got to LA and we started writing sitcoms, and we had some success. So much so that we ended up signing a development deal with 20th Century Fox Television. And they asked us to develop a TV show. This was in like the fall of 2004. And we had two ideas for TV shows that we wanted to do. The first idea, the one that felt like, all right, well, this is the one that's going to be a hit. Was a show about I have to do like a little like historical perspective before explaining this. There was I don't know if you or your listeners know about the Enron scandal in it was like around the early 2000s. It was
I think that's a little before my time, to be honest.
Yeah, it was a big petroleum concern in America, an energy company that they did some shady accounting, and the whole company ended up collapsing as a result, and a lot of people went to jail. So it was a very big news story. And so we thought, wouldn't it be funny? You kept seeing all these accountants going to jail. And we thought, wouldn't it be funny if one of these accountants got sentenced by a judge to teach math in an inner city school? And so this very like kind of like country club preppy white guy accountant shows up in this inner city school, and he has to like, you know, connect with these kids. We felt like, well, that's a show. That's a TV show that I would watch. There's no way that fails. And we started talking to, we talked to David Spade about it, that we kind of wrote it for David Spade, the actor. And he seemed somewhat interested for a little bit. And it seemed like, well, that if one of these is going to go, that's going to be it. So we wrote it. We wrote the pilot, and it was funny, and we sold it. We sold it to Fox, and it felt like, all right, this thing's going somewhere. This thing's got some legs. And then they said, okay, one thing that we need really fast is just a list of five other episodes. Like the first episode is he gets sentenced by the judge. He shows up. It's his first day. He's like scared, but eventually he starts to like maybe win over one or two of them, and like it ends on like a sweet like, oh, I think maybe I can do this. I'm gonna stick around. What are the next five episodes? Which was a good assignment. So we sat down and we spent a weekend like, all right, let's come up with five episodes. And that was when we realized Craig and I know nothing about Enron. We know nothing about accounting. We know nothing about teaching. We know nothing about math. We know nothing about inner city high schools. These are all things that I would love to watch a show about. But like we like realized like, oh my God, we're gonna have to like research this thing because we know nothing about this. This is not our world. And that show ended up not going anywhere. Just partly, I think, because of that, because the ideas that we just didn't have any more ideas. The other idea we had was the thing that we thought like, well, this will never go anywhere, but let's just write it because we want to write it. which was kind of something that, like, it started out with something that I was just almost like, in lieu of going to a therapist, I just wrote this, started, Craig and I wrote this thing of, like, the fact that I was coming around the corner of 30 and was single. And I had always, like, had these very traditional impulses in me that I felt like I want to be married by the time I'm 30. I want to have a family. I want to have kids. I want to do all that stuff. That's, like, very high on my agenda of things to do. And yet I keep falling in love with the wrong people. And I keep, like, just striking out and just being really bad at dating. This is before the era of apps. So this is back when you had to, like, walk up and start talking to someone and ask them out instead. It was like, and I was a nightmare at it. It sounds horrible. Yeah, it was horrible. And I had this moment where I felt like, you know, I think I'd be, once I'm past all this nonsense, I think I'd be good at, like, being in a relationship and being like being a husband and a father. I think I'd be good at that stuff. But, like, I can't get past this dating stuff in order to get to that point. So we kind of wrote all that. We wrote all that in a story. And in a script. Now, this was at a time when Friends was in its final season, or had just gone off the air, I think. And Joey, they were doing a spinoff of Joey. It just felt like, well, they're not gonna. It's too much like Friends. It's like, you know, just the, you know, we're writing about our lives and it's autobiographical. But and also, you know, I should include that, like, the other half of the story is Craig being newly married. And he was, like, he and his wife are the first people in our friend group to get married. And, like, suddenly, they're just, like, living this, like, this old fogey lifestyle while the rest of us are out, like, still, like, whooping it up. So he was kind of, like, grappling with that. And we wrote this thing. It felt too much like Friends. So we sort of thought, like, well, this will probably, everyone will say, oh, it's too much like Friends. The one thing I think that set it apart was, we didn't have a title for it. And I was going through, like, a list of old titles. Like, and sometimes I just keep lists in notebooks, and I kept a list of, like, hey, these would be good titles for things. If I ever, like, want to write something, like if I have an idea for a title, but I don't know what it is, I'd write down the title. And on that list was the words, How I Met Your Mother. And when I saw that, that was when it kind of clicked together. It was like the two things interlocked. And it felt like, oh, this is a way to make this different from Friends. And to give it a whole other element of, like, a storytelling device that allows you to just do all this incredible stuff by framing a show like Friends as a father telling his kids the stories of his wild days in his 20s. And that just kicked the door open and made us feel like, okay, this is something we could actually do. And sort of the proof in the pudding was, you know, we sold the script and we sold it to CBS, which we didn't expect. We didn't expect CBS to be the one to pick it up because they weren't traditionally this kind of network to do this kind of show. But they had just, you know, because Friends had just gone off the air, they wisely said there's now a hole in the market for this kind of show, a show that 20-somethings can see their lives, their screwed up single dating lives on screen. And so they picked it up. And they asked us the question, like, what are 5 more episodes of this show? And we were just like, we've got a list of 100 episodes. Like, I how many times have I, like, gone on a date and made a fool of myself? Like, we will never run out of ideas for this. We can do 100 episodes. And we ended up doing 208. And that was, you know, some of them were dumb stuff that I've done in my life. And some of them were dumb stuff Craig has done. Some of them were dumb stuff that other writers on our staff, because we made sure to, like, assemble a staff of people who also had gone through this kind of stuff. The rest is history, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot to unpack here. So,
yes.
I personally, I've seen How I Met Your Mother twice through. I'm watching it again with my girlfriend right now. And, nice. You know, it's one of my favorites. Yeah, I'm not necessarily taking advice from Barney at the moment. Maybe Ollie's more is more on that kind of track right now. But anyway,
I'm keeping to myself.
But. Anyway, so just coming quickly to the friends similarities. Ultimately, I think when I watched it the first time, at least as someone who saw Friends before it, I did feel like there were quite a lot of similarities. You know, 20 somethings in New York, you guys kind of use some of the similar tropes, like there's this game show episode, you know, Barney appears on a game show. I think it was Joey also appeared in a game show. So like, I noticed these small like similarities where I'm like, yeah, okay.
Let me finish your question.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, do you think this popularity of How I Met Your Mother kind of was tied up with that hype around Friends? And do you think that you guys were able to take something successful and make it your own? Is that how you kind of conceived of it?
As a writer, I always feel like I don't want to waste my time doing something someone else has done before. And I struggle with that. I struggle with like originality and I've always resisted like the idea to like, you know, I've had people come to me with offers to like work on IP, you know, and like, I not to take anything away from people who do like Marvel movies or whatever, but I've always tried to I want to leave my own thumbprint on the world. And so, you know, we did struggle with like, we want to make sure this is different from Friends. I think I'm sure that it drafted off of Friends' success. Friends was a phenomenal show that it's hard to deny that it definitely paved the way in the marketplace for a show like How I Met Your Mother. And it's funny, I watched Friends and I don't think I've seen every episode. I there's like a few seasons that I watched every week. But it's funny, there are things like, for instance, somebody pointed this out to me recently that there was in our first season, we did an episode where Ted breaks up with a girl on her birthday. And he doesn't realize it's her birthday, but it is her birthday, and he breaks up with her, and he feels terrible about it. And somebody pointed out to me that Friends did an episode like that, which I don't remember. But not only did they do that episode, it was the same actress who I believe her name was Annie Dudek, like played like had the same role. And no one told us this like while we were making it. And certainly Annie Dudek never told us that because, you know, it's, you know, she's from her perspective, it's a job. And okay, I'll come play this part. But like, it was just sort of a, and it's, you know, we did 208 episodes and they did I don't know, like 300 episodes or something like that. Like eventually you're going to hit the same targets. I mean, it's a bunch of white people dating in New York. It's like, it's a small world and you're going to have the same. And also we did, one of the other things is that we had a writer, we had two writers from Friends. So like, anytime something like that happened, we kind of look at them like, you didn't want to tell us that, and then they'd be like, oh yeah, I guess we did do that episode. It's like, all right. But like, yeah, like Barney being on a game show, for me, that I go back to Cliff Clavin from Cheers going on Jeopardy, which felt like that for me was sort of probably the blueprint for the Barney, Price is Right thing. But yeah. Mm.
So obviously the show just picked up so much success and instantly you're kind of thrust into the spotlight as the guy who created How I Met Your Mother, which is an immensely positive thing to begin with. But what I hear a lot of creatives saying is that they feel almost like once they've had such a certain big role, and I hear actors say this a lot, sometimes you can betray yourself in a way and be known as the person who did X. And yet, just very recently, you wrote The Mutual Friend, which I loved. And I wanted to ask you about your process of... Which I no worries, it was really good. I wanted to ask you about the process of redefining yourself and how you found that.
That's a great question. Thank you for asking that, and thank you for bringing up The Mutual Friend. I'm so proud of it, and like I've had to grapple with this. I've definitely had to grapple with this idea of like, I remember talking on the phone with Bryan Cranston, who appeared on our show in like the second or third season, and then came back and did a guest starring role. He did our show, then went off and did the entirety of Breaking Bad, and then came back like after Breaking Bad ended, which is like tells you what a mensch this person is, that he like it's like a month after Breaking Bad ended and we say like, hey, do you want to come reprise your role on How I Met Your Mother as Ted's crazy boss? And he's like, sure. And like he comes back and does it and was like, you know, hit it out of the park as he did before. And like he's probably one of our greatest, if not our greatest TV actors and can do anything. But I remember talking to him on the phone when we were discussing like what he'd be doing in season 9 and just talking about like, you know, we were both sort of in this position of like going through this experience of ending the role that ending the project that will eventually define us. And I remember him saying like, how does it feel? It sort of him observing that like, here we are finishing up the project that will be the first sentence of our obituary, which like, and when he said that, it made me shudder. Cause like I'm 39 at the time. I'm like, really, is this, am I, oh God, is this, and it really was like, and like for, you know, and also for like for him, it's like, well, yeah, you get to be the guy from Breaking Bad, the greatest TV show of all time. And like, I'm just running this like rinketing TV sitcom. But that being said, like it is something that I've grappled with. These last 10 years have definitely been a reckoning in terms of like realizing that nothing will replace this show. And also as the TV business has changed, especially that I don't see a future where there's another show with this kind of reach and this kind of like the kind of like audience that we were able to amass. Like people don't, there's no show that 8 million people sit down and watch every night. That just doesn't exist anymore. And so I, you know, it all comes back to gratitude, which is like such a corny thing that people talk about, but gratitude is like at the bottom of it, it is like, you know, I got to work on this thing for 9 years that, it, you know, if it is if it was the only thing on my obituary, how could you not be happy with that? This was like a wonderful experience. Yeah. And more importantly, I made some of the best friends of my life doing it. I got to satisfy every creative itch. I mean, we created this sandbox that we could play in where if we wanted to do the saddest, most tearjerkery story we could think of, we could do that. If we wanted to do a silly farce, we could do that. If we wanted to do a film noir, we could do that. If we wanted to have a mystery, we could write a mystery. Like the thing I'm most proud of is that we took the contours of, you know, a cast of 5 main actors and 2 sets and did as much as we possibly could with those ingredients over the course of, we didn't do 200 episodes that were all basically exactly the same. I think we really like, we stretched the medium as much as we could. And I'm proud of that. And then there's a long way of getting to, I found myself as it ended, happy with the idea that this will be the thing I'm most known for. But then I started writing, then I started having ideas for The Mutual Friend, and The Mutual Friend actually started its life as a pilot that Craig and I developed together. I brought it to Craig and we sort of tried to develop and we tried to turn it into a TV show. And then part of the thinking was like, well, now that we've worked for a network sitcom where we did get to do like almost everything we ever wanted to do. But it was like, we were hemmed in by like the expectations of a network sitcom. And so I thought, well, now what's the story we could do that actually like the real genesis of it actually was How I Met Your Father or How I Met Your Dad. Sorry. After How I Met Your Mother, we developed, or like in the final season of How I Met Your Mother, like side by side, we were developing with another writer, this woman, Emily Spivey.
And with Greta Gerwig, no, as well,
I
love her.
I mean, who doesn't love her? Yeah. I mean, and it was, well, I guess there's one guy who apparently didn't love her because the show didn't go. It didn't get picked up. And the world got Lady Bird, Little Women, and Barbie out of the deal. So it's like probably, maybe it's for the best that didn't get picked up, but
good trade.
Yeah. It's a good trade. But I did feel like, you know, there's more of a story to tell and it didn't get picked up, but they said, well, hey, come back to us next year and develop it again next year. And I already felt like I just felt like it feels like development hell. It feels like we were a little dissatisfied with the way CBS handled it. And it just sort of felt like we were handing them something that could have been incredible. And they just sort of tossed it aside to go with some, and not to take anything away. I won't judge their choices. They chose the shows they chose that year, and that's fine. But it kind of felt like, I don't know, like I'm not, especially coming off of How I Met Your Mother, it felt like I'm not going to go chasing this. I'm not going to go like go running after it. Like I've got two kids. I had two very young kids. We had a third kid on the way, and I just felt like I'm moving into dad mode. I'm moving into family mode, and I didn't necessarily want to like run a network sitcom again. Mm-hmm. But the question of redeveloping it did lodge in my head, and I sort of started thinking like, well, what would be different about what could this show do differently that How I Met Your Mother didn't do? Like, because we did so much on How I Met Your Mother, what could set the show apart? And I just moved to New York at this point. I was like taking these long walks and just thinking. And on my walks, I just kind of realized, like every now and then, I'm checking my phone, and I realized like it's the phones. That's what's different. Like dating has changed mm-hmm. just since we started writing about dating in 2005. Just in that 9-year period, the whole game has changed, and now everything is on the phones. And that got me thinking a lot about technology. It got me thinking a lot about like our relationship to technology and how much it's changed over my lifetime. And that was sort of the inception of The Mutual Friend. And that was sort of the jumping off point. Sorry.
That's a good intro, because I was going to ask you about, one of the themes I wanted to get into you is partially social media, technology, partially finding purpose, dating, etc. But building from that, before we get into that, how would you give an elevator pitch of The Mutual Friend to somebody who hasn't read it or somebody who's interested in reading it?
I've never been able to do that. And it's really, I think it's the thing that's probably, I mean, a number of things have maybe held it back from being a number one New York Times bestseller. But like, it's interesting because, you know, it got sold in America as a romantic comedy and a romance. And like, it was listed in the romance novel at first. And I had to like fight against that, because it's like, there's some romantic elements in it, but it's like, I felt like it was about much more than that. My elevator pitch is it's more thematic. It's more like it's an exploration of our relationship to technology, and in a way that is intentionally not like, I didn't want to do the thing like, and my elevator pitch is saying what it isn't, but what it isn't is this scoldy, hey, put down your phones. Come on, guys, put your phones down. Pay attention to real life. I didn't want to do that, because you can't do that. That's like real. It was sort of acknowledging that real life is now taking place inside our phones. Like, this is where we, I'm just showed you my kids. Those are my kids right there. But like inside our phones is where these things are happening, and is where like our lives are taking place. We're dating there. We're buying our socks there. We're like, you know, I found out I was going to be a father for the first time when my wife sent me an email. The subject was, are you sitting down? And it was just a picture of a pregnancy test. And like, that's how that moment happened in my life. And like, I don't know. I just sort of wanted to like acknowledge like do a story of people grappling. It's okay. It's the story of multiple characters. This is the elevator pitch. Multiple characters grappling with the fact that we as a species are interacting with each other in a way that we are not evolved to do so. And mm-hmm. and that in 10,000 years, 20,000 years of human civilization, we nothing has prepared us for this, and yet somehow we have to live in it and make sense of it. Mm. That's the elevator.
It reminds
pitch.
Me of that's a great way to sum
and
it
I think
up.
We're at my floor, so I'll see you guys.
Yeah.
No, anyway.
It reminds me of a specific scene, I think, which sums it up really well in the book, a particular chapter where Bill, the brother of the main character, is on an expedition in the forest or something like this. And then he realizes he's not. He's actually listening to a podcast whilst he's cycling through Venice. And then all of a sudden he realizes he's not. He's looking at a screen, cycling through Venice on the TV whilst listening to a podcast in his home. And I think, I don't know if you might agree with this idea that the phone has become more real than the external reality itself. And those interactions are prized more above the real ones.
Yeah. Oh, I'm glad you singled that out, because I love that. And I do feel like that scene sort of, I feel like that is kind of setting up a concept that I really wanted to explore and get find every facet of, which is this idea that we are, we live in multiple realities at once nowadays. It was something that I was starting to the idea of that was growing in my head, this idea of there's the reality of our phones and then there's the reality of reality. And then that summer, the summer after How I Met Your Mother, I was sort of like spinning my wheels, looking for something to do. I just moved to New York, and my kids were going to go to the school that was right across the street from Columbia. And so we lived in the Columbia area, Columbia University. And, on a whim one day, I was like, I need something to do this summer. We're not going away. My wife, I can't remember. I think we found out she was, having a baby pretty soon. And so we weren't going to go anywhere. We're just going to have a summer in New York. And just on a whim, I was like, I wonder if Columbia University has classes for normal people who just wander in off the street. I wonder if that exists. And sure enough, they had a thing that was the School of Continuing Education, where you could sign up to take a class at Columbia, taught by an actual Columbia professor in a Columbia lecture hall, without having to apply to Columbia. And I saw that there was one that was Intro to East Asian Buddhism. My wife's family is from Thailand, and she and they're Chinese originally, and they her mother's Buddhist, and my children were had Buddhist ceremonies when they were born, but I don't know anything about Buddhism. So I thought this could be interesting. I'm going to take this class. And I took the class, and it blew my mind. It was the best experience of my life. It's, and this ended up in the book, because this is what Bill goes through. He just on a whim decides to take a class on Buddhism. And
Bill did.
No. Bill is kind of me minus me with the brakes cut, basically. I was able to hit the brakes and be all right, this is fun, but I am a dad and I do have responsibilities. But Bill just goes for it. But in the class, the sort of one of the precepts of Buddhism that I didn't know about was this idea of sort of the duality of the two realities that we live in. I'm forgetting the terminology now. There's the real world and the spiritual world, or the
material and non-material, or something like that.
The material and non-material, sort of the eternal and the temporal. And the way the professor described those worlds reminded me a lot of the way I think I often think about, the real world and the world inside our phones. And that sort of it's the kind of thing where you think about blue cars and suddenly you see blue cars everywhere. And it's sort of as soon as I started thinking in that paradigm, ideas started forming and the world started coming together. And that it led to sort of observations like that, where you can be climbing cycling through Venice and also at a crime scene in the woods and also in your basement,
Just to jump in here, because you mentioned thinking about blue cars and blue cars appear everywhere. And that reminds me of one of my favorite How I Met Your Mother episodes, which is after Ted asks Robin, do you love me? And she says no. And then you've got this amazing Florence and the Machine track. Robin moves out. He walks outside and there's yellow umbrellas everywhere. And that kind of, reminds me of this idea of what you said about blue cars, but there's also another element to it, which I kind of wanted to unpack. Basically, this idea of different levels of reality also coming out on a structural level and a storytelling level. So in the same way that maybe in your new book, people's experiences of the world are mediated through technology, a lot of what's going on in How I Met Your Mother is mediated through TED. And you've got this unreliable narrator. And it's something which I wrote about a little bit this year in my dissertation about different forms of mediation in art. You know, you've got you, the writer, mediating what the characters are doing and also mediating what the actors are doing. But you've also got Ted, who's constantly mediating, and the structure of How I Met Your Mother itself, which is literally constant flashbacks. And in that vein, I was wondering, did you guys ever feel, there's a little bit of a sidestep, but it's the same idea of mediation and the way that kind of the structure and the form might be mediating you, the writer, yourself. Do you ever feel kind of restricted by that form that you had set out from the outset? So you said, okay, we're going to tell it in this way. Did you feel like, okay, now we need to stick by it? Or how did that kind of play out?
No, I felt like it, as soon as we sort of unlocked that universe of being able to step out the stories and let the stories be tall tales when they needed to be, it sort of allowed us to, like, if we wanted to have something crazy happen, we knew that the way we do it on the show is not just presented to the audience and says, here's a crazy thing that never could have happened. We have it, you know, like for instance, Marshall getting mugged by a monkey. Like, if we just did an episode where Marshall goes to the zoo and a monkey picks his pocket, you'd think, well, that's crazy. And then, you know, that came out of, like, there are plenty of stories of, like, in countries where monkeys are out and about, you know, as common as squirrels, like, people get their stuff stolen by monkeys all the time. It actually is it's a thing. Marshall getting mugged by a monkey at the Central Park Zoo is absurd on its face, but it's also funny. And we sort of, we wanted to see that moment, but we also knew, like, well, we could never actually do that unless we made it a story about storytelling and a story about, like maybe it's not true, but, like, there's a reason that he's telling the story and it's not true. For me, the moment in the pilot where we sort of realized, like, oh, there's, like, it's sort of like discovering this, like, you know, you find, like, a little tiny cave, you know, in your backyard, and then you wander into it for a little bit and you're going with your flashlight, and then all of a sudden you find this giant cavern with, like, tunnels and things to explore. It felt like this, like the moment in the pilot when I think it was when Ted tells Robin he loves her, when he says, like, I love you, and it's on the first date, and he says it way too soon. And you pop through Ted telling the story to his friends at the bar, and they go, what? And then you go to the kids and they say, what? And just sort of, like, I love that, you know, and this happens serendipitously, but, you know, Barney's catchphrase is, you know, it's going to be legend, wait for it, dairy, legendary. Like, legendary is his, like, word. And that just felt like a fun catchphrase. And, like, I think that was Chris Miller and Phil Lord who came up with that. But for me, that sort of unlocked this whole idea that, like, that's what the series is about. Is about legends. It's about how the events of our lives become the stuff of legend the more they get told as stories, and the bigger and crazier they get, the further away you get from it. And every crazy thing that Ted tells his kids that Uncle Barney did, maybe he didn't do it, but it's a good story, and so he's telling it. That was sort of where we realized, like, that this structure, as opposed to, like, hampering us in any way, it, like, makes anything possible on the show. We could do any kind of story as long as, you know, you frame it as it's a story being told, and it's a story that, like, maybe is being, you know, spiced up a little bit to make it an interesting story.
Yeah, and I think it's so interesting how you pick out kind of legend, wait for a dairy, as kind of this metonym for the whole show's ability to kind of subvert expectation. And, you know, he's breaking up the word legendary, and it's something that's also kind of subverting expectation, because I don't know if this is true, but I think sometimes he's legend, wait for it, and then he'll change what comes next. So in that way, it's interesting what you mentioned from the pilot about, you know, he tells Robin, I love you. The group says what? And then, you go zoom out again, and his kids say, "What? I feel like the flashback form of the show allows for jokes to come out on the structural and the meta level rather than just the content level, if you know what I mean."
Yeah. Yeah, I for sure. I you know, we always tried to, the one thing that I always tried to leave, the one sort of membrane that we tried to leave unpierced was the third wall. Like I sort of felt like, the final audience, as far as like from our perspective, making the show was the kids on the couch. And I didn't want to do things. I always struggled against doing things that nodded to the fact that, oh, we're a TV show and you're also watching this at home. I think it partly was like out of a sense of like other shows are doing that and doing that better. Like I felt like Community was a really good show and that was constantly commenting on the fact that it is a TV show. And 30 Rock also, I think was very good at that. So that was the one thing that I always sort of I love meta humor, but I tried to keep it. It would be meta, but within the universe of the show, like you would have things like, you know, the song Murder Train by Robin's ex-boyfriend's band would play over another scene later on when Marshall's fighting with his brothers. And like, it's, you know, commenting. I always like, and sometimes we would do things that like, you know, do references to other movies. And I feel like once or twice we did a thing about Doogie Howser with Neil, but I always like tried to avoid those. I always tried to like keep an airtight seal around the universe of the show as much as we could.
Yeah. It's interesting though, how the even keeping it within the fourth wall, the structure can be multi-layered like that. And that allows for comedy and different points of tension. And that's what brings in the storytelling element. So to contrast it back to the book, I wanted to ask what you find interesting or different in the medium of a novel that allows you to do interesting things like that, or where the differences are for you.
The big thing for me, I mean, aside from like the process was so different because I was used to writing, you know, How I Met Your Mother was written in a room with 10 other people. And so much of it came out of this sort of party atmosphere. Like it was like every day you're going to a cocktail party, with minus the alcohol. Usually sometimes there was alcohol, but you know, it was just a fun environment, and it was very social, and writing a novel is obviously just sitting quietly in a room alone. But that being said, I in the way that like, you know, within a 22 minute sitcom on CBS, like you immediately see where the walls are and where the contours are and what you have to work within. And, you find a way to like create the whole universe in this little box. And, the contours are different in a novel because, you know, you're not working visually. You don't like, you know, when you describe a character, like the audience doesn't see their face, you know, they don't see like a beautiful shot. You have to describe the shot. But you can also, for instance, you can do a scene in Hawaii on a beach in Hawaii. And, you know, if I wrote a scene on a beach in Hawaii on How I Met Your Mother, I'd like within 5 minutes, I'd get a call from the supervising producer, Susie Greenberg, saying like, we're not going to Hawaii to shoot one scene. Forget it. That's going to cost thousands of dollars. And we're not going to do it. With a book you can. And so, I tried to like, and I think that shows in this book that I really like, I tried to go for it. I tried to really go for it. Like it's the benefit of this. And this is partly why I was drawn to writing fiction in the first place, because television writing it's great when you have a show that's on the air and running and you have an episode order. And they say like, we're making 24 episodes of How I Met Your Mother. We don't know what's going to be in those episodes, but we're making them. Here's the money. Go make them. That's a great feeling, because then it's just like, now I get to like come up with anything and it'll go on the air and it'll come to life. In the years since then, the hard lesson I learned is like, it's a lot different writing on spec, because on spec, you know, you have to write a script that's so good that it gets someone to give you that millions of dollars to make it, which is, you know, it's hard to get someone to give you millions of dollars. That's just a fact. And as a result, I think Craig and I wrote a bunch of pilot episodes of various shows. We wrote like something like 7 pilots or something after How I Met Your Mother ended. And it's fun writing a pilot. And we made a few of them. We shot them and got to work with actors and had a great time making them. But then at the end of the day, they don't get picked up. And it's like, well, thank you for chapter one of this story. And there will never be a chapter two, you know, on to the next thing, which is like, that's the business. And like, you know, on some level you make peace with that. But after a while, I kind of felt like I just had a big stack of chapter ones, and I just felt like I miss the feeling of finishing a story, and I miss the feeling of putting out a finished product. You know, I you know, this came out in 2022, which was, you know, about like 8 years after the last thing that had gone out into the public with my name on it, which felt like, you know, aside from like a couple like songs for Sesame Street and things, the little odds and ends that Craig and I had done. But like, I don't know, I felt like I wanted to interact with the audience and like make something that an audience can see and interact with. And all these pilots kept getting buried and disappearing. The appeal of writing a book is you write the book, and if someone agrees to publish it, then the artistic process, like the loop closes, and you have finished that artistic process, and you have created this thing that is a final product, and it exists and it's in the world, and there's not like another step where, okay, now I have to convince, you know, this actor to be in it, and I have to convince this studio to make it. It's like, I felt like it felt good to have a finished product, and it felt good to, and that was the appeal. And that was the thing that drew me to writing fiction, as opposed to television, I think.
From my perspective, I think having read the book, and comparing it to How I Met Your Mother, it feels like, and I'll explain myself a bit, but it feels like you can bring more of yourself into it. So when you're writing, and it's from focalized from the first person perspective, even if written in third person, you're kind of bringing out the subjectivities of what it's like to be on a phone really, really, really well, because you're speaking as the person, and you're in the middle of a writing, and then all of a sudden they get a text, and the whole text changes and things. And that's like it's a very good like firsthand experience. And it makes me want to ask about the character Grover Keynes. Is it Keynes? I'm not sure how to pronounce it correctly.
Kynes, I think. Kynes, yeah.
Grover Kynes. And there's a line which goes something like, he's an ethicist because he's making up, or he's laundering his assholery through ethics, and how people do that often. they use the thing to remedy something in themselves. And I think with the writerly process, that's quite similar. So how much of you personally are you putting into the book, if that makes sense?
Oh, a tremendous amount. And that is the you know, when you're writing with a group, you know, you the good thing is that there's 10 times more ideas floating around, but the bad thing is that like every idea has to sort of get through that, you know, everyone else has to approve it. And this was definitely like me being able to just like, this is me for better, for worse. This is like all things about me and maybe like even things that I'm not entirely comfortable with, but I'm laundering my own assholery by writing this book, you know, like, I feel like, my starting off point with each of the characters was to kind of find a way to like my way. Cause I the goal of the book was to really create this sort of like universe of, I wanted to write as many three-dimensional characters as possible and give every character dimension and give every character like more than just like a surface level of like the waiter that comes on and takes their order. So as a guiding principle, I tried to think of every character as some version of me minus something or plus something. Like with Bill, for instance, Bill is very much like me, especially at that time. he's just finished up this big project and he's like financially very stable, but he's doesn't know what to do with the rest of his life. And that was 100% me. So Bill is me minus the fact that I love my wife and I love my kids and I love I was interested in Buddhism. I was interested in studying it. I don't want to become a monk. It's not that I know that that's not in my future, but like, if I didn't have that thing in me, that break, that governor that stops it, like maybe I would like end up like joining joining the Sangha and going into a monastery. And with all the characters, it's like that, you know. I think with Bob, who's sort of the toxic bachelor of the story, and there's a he has a monologue that sort of like hints at this, where he like feels like he says like, I feel like I'm the alternate reality of some better reality. I don't feel like I'm reality. I feel like I'm someone else minus some bad choices or plus some bad choices. And I feel like Bob is me, like a version of me that makes worse choices. And also, I got married before dating apps became a thing. And I just felt like if I hadn't met my wife, if I hadn't gotten married and settled down, like, I don't know how I would behave being someone out on dating apps. I don't know. Like, I'd like to think that I would behave in a sensible and ethical way. But like, I mean, it's, you know, I've seen it with my friends that have like gone through it. And I know that like the world went crazy with these dating apps. And so Bob was kind of represented like, this is like a version of me, but like, if that had happened and particularly Alice, I think, and this is getting back to the, you know, trying to find the really subjective experience of like your phone interrupting you constantly. Like Alice, she's the protagonist of the book, and she's her central story is her trying to study for, the MCAT so she can become a doctor. And she just has one summer to study. Essentially, Alice is a writer's block story. I mean, there've been so many writer's block stories of like, you know, like, I mean, some of my favorite pieces of art, like Barton Fink is like the greatest writer's block story of all time. And I didn't want to write about a writer, and I wanted to like raise the stakes of like, you know, have like the thing that she's working on ultimately being the thing that like will save lives and will make the world a better place. So like, let's hope that she becomes a doctor. But her experience of sitting in a cafe trying to study is my experience of sitting in a cafe trying to write The Mutual Friend and trying to write the book and like sitting down and like, oh, I need to get the right playlist. So I'll spend the whole morning figuring out the playlist. And then suddenly I've spent the whole afternoon and suddenly it's like, oh, I just spent the day working on my playlist. And that's all I did. All of those experiences came from my own just subjective, like just sort of watching myself and seeing how just life gets interrupted by this exterior noise that is constantly bombarding us from every angle.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because when it comes to writing, and whether it's writing a TV show like How I Met Your Mother or a book like The Mutual Friend, there is such an element of choice involved. You could have ended the show in quite a few different ways. And this brings me back to a question which you've probably been asked before about the finale of How I Met Your Mother, which I actually really liked. I always wanted Ted to get back with Robin. I thought they should have done it. And the motif of the blue French horn, you know, it's always the one that carried so much emotional weight for me. So I liked it. But, you know, unfortunately, not everyone did. And I was wondering, do you create a show or a piece of art? Do you create that for the audience, like necessarily for the audience, or kind of as a separate piece as itself, something quite separate and on its own?
That's a good question. Because I think there's no... I mean, that's just an existential question for any artist, because I don't think there's any, I don't think there's any right answer to that. I think like on one hand, you have to write something that you're happy with. And you are the first audience member. Like Stephen King in his book on writing, he describes the reason he works without outlines. Well, the reason he doesn't plan his books out in advance is because he wants to, he's sort of like locked into this idea that as the writer, you're the first reader of the book. And so he wants to be surprised as a reader when, you know, Cujo the rabid dog attacks, you know, like he wants to surprise himself and he wants to scare himself. And in that sense, you know, your own barometer, you are like making art for yourself and you are making something that, you know, you find satisfying. On the other hand, you know, and this is the lesson I learned writing for Letterman, which is like, there were plenty of times when we would make some bit of comedy that made us laugh as a writing staff. And more often than not, it was sort of the joke of it would be, could you imagine if we actually put this on TV? And then we'd want to put it on TV. And we'd put it on TV and it wouldn't get a laugh exactly as we might have expected. And, you know, the lesson we would learn from it is like, you can't cut out the audience. The audience is the reason you're here. And the audience is the, you know, the in big ways and little way. I mean, just purely like from a comedy perspective, like if you don't hear a laugh, you have to change it. You have to change that joke. You might love it, but like, if it doesn't get a laugh, don't do it. Don't do something that people don't laugh at. I mean, which, you know, and then that swings you back to the other way of like, well, maybe someone else will laugh at it 10 years from now. Maybe someone will laugh at it. You know, it's, there's no way to know. There's no way to know, but I do know that I don't know. It's not all for the audience and it's not all for the writer, but it's, sure, it's somewhere in between, I think, for sure.
I mean, did you like the finale? I'll ask you that first of all.
I'm just going to say there's an alternate ending to the show that I really like that it was the last thing that I did on the show. It was with Bob Saget. It was like the last thing I did working with Bob Saget that I felt like also just on an emotional level, just, I felt very connected to Ted and very connected to Tracy. And I sort of loved the idea of them living happily ever after. I'm not going to say, I don't know. I feel like, it's a very complicated issue and it's a very, I guess I'm just happy that there are two endings out there and that, you know, not that television should be something you order off a restaurant menu, but I like that there is a version where there's a happy ending for Ted and Tracy. I don't know. I guess I like them both. I don't know. No comment. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't know how to answer it, honestly. But I'll just leave it at that.
Well, just as fan service, maybe, could you go a little bit more into detail about how the other ending might have gone down with the happy ending for Ted?
It's on YouTube and people can watch it. They can find it. It was released on the DVD set. So it's there if people want to see it.
It's so interesting though that kind of two endings exist, because it really makes you kind of aware of the almost the artificiality of a piece of art or a TV show. There is someone creating it. There is someone making those decisions. So you have two endings that actually coexist within the same universe. They're not really separate from each other in some way. Do you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah. It's, I don't know. I feel like it's a complicated thing. And I mean, there is, you know, it's the ending is the ending and we have an official ending and, you know, I'm proud of the show and I love the show and I think I'll leave it at that. But maybe it was just scratching my own little itch to like Steve. I mean, part of it, you know, I had just gotten married at the time and I sort of felt like this connection with Ted and Tracy. So I'm glad that we were able to do that. I was able to like, just put that together. But anyway, I don't want to be on record saying I didn't like the ending. I love the ending. I love the whole series, but yeah, I'll just leave it at that.
Absolutely. And I kind of, just to kind of come towards, the end here, before we ask you what's next for Carter Bays, I just wanted to pick up on the idea of spin-offs quickly, because, you know, obviously in How I Met Your Father, which unfortunately got cancelled recently, you have kind of these reprisals of Barney and of Robin. And my question is less about those themselves, because, you know, those happened, those might have worked, might not have worked. I'm more just curious about why you think a spin-off in general kind of might and might not work. So Joey, for example, didn't work at all. But Frasier is one of my favorite shows of all time, and that came from Cheers. So what's your opinion on that?
I more and more realize that, like, it's spin-off, the whole concept of spin-off is just, like, just to get you to that first episode. And so much of television is just, like, find the hook that, like, gets people to tune in. And then beyond that, once people have tuned in, you will live or die by just a few basic things, which is, like, number one, a great cast, and number two, great writing. And I think, like, Frasier, for instance, and this doesn't take anything away from the cast of Joey or the writers from Joey. I think they were probably all great writers, and the cast was probably have all gone on to do wonderful things in their own right. I don't even remember who was in that, but, like, Frasier as a cast, you know, you had John Mahoney and you had David Hyde Pierce and you had Perry Gilpin and you had, you know, these people who came in and just solidified that, you know, this is a show that you're going to want to tune into every week. I think, like, cast is everything. Cast is even more than writing. I think, like, and if you have a great cast, then a spinoff is absolutely worth doing. And if you don't have the right cast, then it's not. And by the right cast, I don't even mean the most talented cast, because I think there's plenty of shows that have great casts, but for whatever reason, they're not right for this particular project, and they don't click together on screen the way the cast of Frasier did. I say Frasier because that's, you know, the undefeated champion of spinoffs.
It came back recently.
It's being run by a guy from How I Met Your Mother, Chris Harris. So,
wow. Amazing. No, and I mean, in general, I think you're right in that it really is about how that show stands on its own, not necessarily kind of hanging on to what it might be spinning off of, just like how Better Call Saul was just really successful on its own.
Yeah.
But just because I did set it up, I wanted to ask you what's next for you, Carter? What's the next step?
I have a few things sort of cooking. I just finished writing a play that I'm hoping to.
Wow.
It started its life as a screenplay, and I sort of, like, had this moment of realizing, like, oh, this can maybe work on stage. And so I adapted it and had a lot of fun adapting it. And so I'm hoping to, you know, again, it's all about just, like, putting product out there. I want to, like, having done the book, I sort of feel like I just want to, like, I want to continue the conversation with the audience. So I'm hoping to, like, get this play up and running somewhere. I also have I've been developing for the last couple of years, this would be a departure. It would be a 10 episode miniseries about the Hokulea, which is a Polynesian voyaging canoe that was built in the 1970s in Hawaii by a group called the Polynesian Voyaging Society, in order to prove that the Hawaiian people had migrated from Tahiti, and not only had migrated from Tahiti, but were able to travel back and forth between Hawaii and Tahiti in these voyaging canoes using celestial navigation. In the 1970s, it was at a time when people didn't believe that. And people thought that, like, oh, they just arrived on rafts and they accidentally got blown off course because they were out fishing and then just kind of just happened to end up there. But which contributed to, I think, allowed these, like, sort of almost racist narratives to pervade of this idea that, like, the people in Hawaii didn't, you know, couldn't really achieve anything interesting. In fact, there's this incredible history of Polynesian voyaging that's been kept alive in through the oral tradition. And these guys basically set out to do a thing that nobody had done in 500 years, which was just without any maps or compasses or GPS, find their way from Hawaii to Tahiti and back in this like just canoe that's just basically two trees tied together with twine and a sail. And it's an incredible story that is not just a story of adventure on the high seas, but also sort of the story of the Hawaiian Renaissance and Hawaii, the Hawaiian people sort of coming into their own, and re-embracing their history and their culture after 200 years of colonial rule. I've been working with this group, the Polynesian Voyaging Society, developing it. I'm working with a wonderful writer named Justin Ochong, and I'm really hoping that we can find a place for it and find a way to get it made, because it's like every now and then you like, I'm not someone who like writes nonfiction. I've historically just made up stories, but like every now and then you hear a story and it's like, well, the world has to hear this story, and this story has to be told. And this is one of those stories. It's just too incredible. And so I'm hoping that one comes to fruition.
Well, yeah, I mean, best of luck with that. We'll keep an eye out, certainly. And for all those watching, you guys should also keep an eye out. But we also really wanted to thank you for joining us today, Kurt. We really appreciate it, really enjoyed the conversation. And we're wondering if you had any concluding thoughts for our audience on the Loaf Podcast.
No, I'm so grateful to be here. I love Oxford. Are you guys students at Oxford?
Students.
I love your school. I love your town. My family and I came and visited a couple of times. We stayed at the Randolph, which is a wonderful hotel. Bought some. What's the bookstore there? Blackwell's books. I love that bookstore. I was very tickled to be asked and very appreciative to be here. So thank you. And thank you for the nice words about the book. I'm so proud of it. And I'm glad people are discovering it.
Well, thank you, Carter. This has been the Loaf Podcast, signing off.
You guys, I hope you enjoyed that short clip of our episode with Carter Bays. If you want to see the full episode, click right here where we got loads more nuggets of gold. Please like and subscribe to check out our other videos. We've got a huge range of guests, from actors to politicians to academics to sports people. So please do check it out. And as always, I'll see you guys next time.